This podcast is a publication of the Engineering Management Institute, where we are committed to building professional development systems, including project management and people leadership programs that support the growth of engineers and their firms. Download our AE Industry Trends Report for insights on the Great Resignation, remote work productivity, and people-centric cultures. To get your copy, visit engineeringmanagementinstitute.org.
Welcome to this episode of the Civil Engineering Podcast, the first podcast dedicated to helping civil engineering professionals succeed in work and life. I'm your host, James Taylor, and in this episode of the Civil Engineering Podcast, I'll be talking with Tyler Grau, PE, Principal Transportation Engineer at Stanley Consultants, about the significant impacts, challenges, and successes of adapting urban areas to be more accommodating to non-vehicular traffic. Get ready for an insightful conversation that explores the intersection of civil engineering, urban planning, and sustainability. Let's jump into today's episode.
Before we go on here, I'd like to recognize our sponsor for today's episode, Stanley Consultants.
For over a century, Stanley Consultants has been at the forefront of engineering innovation, relentlessly committed to improving lives and building a resilient future. We collaborate with government agencies, utility providers, and private industries to solve some of the most complex challenges in energy, infrastructure, and more. We put people first, leveraging cutting-edge technology and multidisciplinary expertise to deliver differently and exceed expectations. Be a part of our journey to create a connected, sustainable, and enriched world for all. Get in touch with our Stanley Consultants team today.
It's now time for our Civil Engineering Conversation of the Week with Tyler Grau. Tyler, welcome to the Civil Engineering Podcast.
Thank you, James. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here today.
To start off, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself and what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. So after graduating from University of Wisconsin, Madison, I started off in residential land development, which was actually a great starting point because it really gives you the opportunity to dive into a lot of the different civil engineering transportation skills needed. So I did that for a few years and then jumped into public infrastructure right before that 2008 housing crash. So pretty good timing there, landed on my feet at Stanley Consultants and have actually been there since. Had the opportunity to work on a lot of different types of projects, been involved in planning, design, construction, projects like parking lots, but as far reaching as international military bases, so just all over the map. So it's been really fun working here. And my current role, I would say, is more focused on traffic and safety. And so I took on the role as traffic engineering manager in our Chicago office. So these days I'm wearing a lot of hats. I'm trying to grow the group, trying to win and pursue more work, manage our existing work, and then also develop our talent. So it's definitely every day.
That's a lot of hats.
Yeah. And they all fit a little differently. So every day is a little different, but that's what makes it fun to work too.
I'm sure there's a number of people that are listening to this and saying, I know exactly what that feels like of wearing a number of hats. It seems like that happens a lot. The further you go in your career, the more hats you end up wearing. So it sounds like you've had a really cool background and backstory. Can you tell me a little bit, going back to the transportation aspect, can you tell me a little bit about what it means to make an urban zone pedestrian bicycle friendly? Are there limitations for ones to accomplish this goal?
Yeah, so first off, what it essentially is, within an urban area, you are prioritizing and developing an environment that reinforces the needs of pedestrians and bicyclists. So it's really kind of changing the mindset of what an urban zone looks like. It's not meant for just cars, just trucks, but really focusing and making it a priority for a city to provide the necessary infrastructure for that. So it goes into, there's several components as part of that. It's the way we design streets. So focusing on bike-friendly streets, looking at public safety, accessibility, and that's a big issue as well. And then having that network compatibility so that you don't have these isolated pockets, but it's a connected system. So that really develops further and really enhances what you're trying to do there. In terms of limitations, certainly if you don't have the existing infrastructure available, that can be really expensive. So cost is always a limitation with new projects. There's also, you know, you can run into a lot of these types of changes require engaging with the public and elected officials. So public and private resistance can be common. You're trying to change the mindset of what your city looks like. We have this vehicle-driven culture oftentimes. Yeah. And so it can be difficult to overcome that. And you really, one of the strongest ways to overcome that, I think, is having some champions within those cities that are really driving that effort, working with those officials and the public to help understand why it's needed. So I think, you know, funding and kind of that resistance plays a big role. And those are things and hurdles that cities often have to overcome to make those transformative changes.
Right. Right. Now, so I've heard that you were involved in a project in Waterloo, Iowa, called Park Avenue, and I believe it was a road diet implementation project. Can you tell me a little bit more about the details related to that project?
Sure, yeah. So this was a project that was really spearheaded by the Metropolitan Planning Organization, their MPO, and worked with the city of Waterloo. So Park Avenue was a typical four-lane road, 30-mile-per-hour zone within downtown Waterloo, two lanes in each direction. And it has the widest pavement of any of the corridors that are running north-south. So they kind of targeted Park Avenue and looked at it as a way to come up with alternatives that could be more bicycle, pedestrian-friendly. So they're looking at different dedicated options for bikes. And the preferred option was to modify that four-lane roadway into a three-lane section, providing buffered bike lanes. So you had the bike lane with a little separation. The footprint worked out pretty well. And this could all be implemented within the existing pavement. So it really just came down to modifying the pavement markings. So you're changing the pavement markings out and installing some additional signage to transform that corridor. So the new corridor includes one lane in each direction, and then there's left turn lanes at the intersections. The speed limit was reduced to 20 miles per hour, so it went down from 30 to 20, and parking stalls had to be eliminated in some areas so that you could improve visibility. The bicyclists could then get through the intersections more efficiently. So all these components all added up to a more balanced corridor where it's reducing the demand for vehicles, but you're providing this infrastructure to increase the desire for cyclists and pedestrians in the corridor. So it's really trying to balance those needs, and Park Avenue was the one that was chosen by the city to pursue that effort.
So we're making it the pedestrian bike friendly zone, the area there. What were some of those key factors? I know you mentioned safety, obviously reducing the road down, but what are some other things that were looked at to kind of really make it a better place for pedestrians and bikes?
Yeah. So maybe just a little background on Waterloo, Iowa itself. So to help you understand. So the city straddles the Cedar River. So there's downtown components on each side of the Cedar River. And the city has developed a really strong network of off-street trails, but these are more recreation trails, and they don't really connect to each other very well. And so they kind of run parallel opposite sides of the river. And so they're really used on the weekend, more on the recreational side. So one factor that went into Park Avenue being selected is that the city and the MPO needed to find a corridor where they could connect these different trails, connect them to parks, and provide that connection across the river where there isn't currently one. So there's several streets that cross the river. One of the things that was really important with Park Avenue is that the road diet or road right sizing type alternative could be fit within the existing pavement. So some of the other corridors weren't as wide, and that would require either eliminating parking or other more expensive elements to make that conversion. The other item that Park Avenue had lower traffic volumes than some of the other streets that cross the river. Park Avenue was around 5,000 vehicles per day. So that's well within what's recommended as 10,000 or less vehicles per day is kind of like a given that you could do one of these road diets. So it met the ADT, the vehicle traffic volume requirements, and it could be done in an economical way, and it connected a lot of those features like the trails, the parks throughout the city. So Those are a lot of the key things that went into the decision there.
So you talked a little bit about before the lanes, and there were four lanes, reducing it down to one in each direction, and also having the turn lanes. Were there any other specific recommendations that the engineering team had regarding bike lanes and also and signals related to the project?
So the city had gone through and done this conversion and wanted to take it another step further. And that's where Stanley Consultants came in and was retained to help them kind of finalize the pavement markings that were needed and look at the possibility of installing bicycle signals. So we went through, we did a report, some background research to understand the requirements. There's specific requirements that are needed once you want to install bicycle signals. So we took a look at the corridor. And we made sure that one of the things that we needed to make sure is that there was a dedicated bike lane for the signal. So you had to have a dedicated bike lane for a bicycle signal. You can't just have a bicycle signal with no dedicated bike lane. So there were a few locations, few intersections where we had to modify the pavement markings. In addition to that, some additional signs were needed to make it clear that there was a bike signal. And then also the biggest issue with bike signals is you got to restrict the turning movement of vehicles so that they're not conflicting with the bicyclist. So one of the things we added at the intersections were those typical no turn on red signs. So we're restricting vehicles from making that turn that would be conflicting with bicycles. So those were the two main things that we needed to evaluate. Another thing that we looked at as part of improving safety for that corridor was looking at leading intervals. And essentially what a leading interval is it gives that individual or that vehicle, that bicycle, that pedestrian, it gives them a head start into the intersection before the cars actually go. So a leading pedestrian interval, we want to get those pedestrians out into the crosswalk so they're visible. Yeah. So we implemented that, followed by a leading bicycle interval. So that gets them into the intersection. And then the cars get the red, green light. So we want to get those vulnerable users out and visible so that cars can see that they're there, making that easier and more safer to avoid any crashes with those vulnerable users.
And all of this comes back to connectivity, right? I mean, like you're talking about safety, and if you're not comfortable as a pedestrian or someone riding a bike to be using these roadways, I mean, I've heard of level of stress related to bicyclists. And if you have a high level of stress on a bike, you're not going to want to travel on those roadways, right? And that's kind of what all this, it sounds like, was designed to be, was make it a more, provide the connectivity throughout the city, and then also provide the safer for all these people using it, not just the vehicles.
Yeah. The city intentionally reduced the speed limit, and they tried to enforce it as best they could because they're trying to discourage cars. They want to discourage cars from using this corridor. They want it to be a balanced corridor. They have capacity on other streets. And so it's really kind of taking that mindset, like I mentioned earlier, and making it so those users feel comfortable out there.
So a lot of people probably hearing, man, this is a great idea. This sounds fantastic. Would love to see something implemented like this in my city. But it always comes back to what the cost is associated with these types of things. So one of my least favorite questions in the industry is, what are the typical costs? But I'm going to ask you that. What type of costs are we talking about to consider transforming a corridor similar to what you did for Park Avenue?
Yeah, so I guess my recommendation on that would be and I know some agencies around us do this, is whenever they have a resurfacing contract that comes up, they know they're going to be resurfacing a roadway, doing some rehabilitation. That's the time to consider this type of conversion, because you're already changing the pavement. You need to put down new pavement markings. And that's the major cost. If you have a roadway like Park Avenue in Waterloo where the pavement was already wide enough, your costs are pavement markings and signs. And relative to redoing the road itself, those are fairly economical and fairly cheap.
Right.
If you're resurfacing a road, you're going to be putting down pavement markings anyways. So there's really a negligible cost there. Maybe you're adding more pavement markings for delineating bike lanes. And so there's a little bit of a cost there, but it's especially when it's included within one of those roadway projects, it's pennies on the dollar when it comes to that. So that's my recommendation.
I'm sure everyone hearing that's like, that's great.
Yeah. And that, but in order to do that, you really need to have the foresight and the plan and even a plan in place. And how do you evaluate corridors? But that's really the best method. There's a lot of cities and counties and around the country that have come up with a methodology for this already. So there's resources out there to help other cities understand what are the characteristics that you might want to look for when you go to resurface a road. Does it make sense to do this in my community? And you can identify that and do it in a very economical way. But the other issue, when you don't have that pavement width, that's when it becomes more expensive and it becomes like a road reconstruction project. And those are harder to sell to the public too as well, right? So
you're probably also looking at right-of-way acquisition if you haven't a wide. I mean, there's a lot of those things out there as well that can drive the cost higher.
Yeah, more engineering costs, more construction costs, longer duration of the project to get that completed. That you might find some public opposition to it. They don't want to pay all this money to lose a lane of traffic too. So, you know, when you think you're paying money widening the road, people expect you to get more traffic, more travel lanes, and you're kind of doing the opposite. So those can tend to be a little more difficult to push forward. But like I said before, I mean, yeah, if you can package it together with one of those resurfacing projects or an existing project, that's the way to go.
So I like to think of every project and every opportunity as you kind of learn from things. No matter how good a project goes, you learn something during that process. What were some of the lessons learned from implementing the bike lanes and signals on Park Avenue?
Yes. So a few things that stood out, I would say, with the road reconfiguration there, we had the bike lanes on along the curb. So they were all the way to the outside at the edge of the pavement. There was a parking lane between the cars. So is this buffer bike lane, parking and vehicles. And a couple of things that actually were issues with that with the residents is sometimes the people that were parking didn't realize they were parking in a bike lane. They were used to parking at the curb line. And so we've seen pictures of their, and then when one person parks there, the next person pulls in behind them. So you'd get like three or four cars that were parked right in the middle of the bike lane next to where the parking was, and it was marked out. And so part of that was education, maybe some signage to notify that, some ways to better delineate it, the bike lane, whether you're adding some green paint. And that could be a continuous color, or it could just be kind of boxes scattered about, but something to help delineate that bike lane a little better. The other issue that we found was this particular project, the roadway was not resurfaced. So we're dealing with existing pavement, existing conditions. And at the edge of pavement, that's where your drainage structures are. And oftentimes, that's where pavement cracking and settling can happen. And that's right in the bike lane. So that was one other issue that if you're not redoing the project or resurfacing the project and making those improvements, that can be one reason to consider avoiding having those bike lanes at the edge of the roadway. So that, in addition to maintaining the bike lanes, keeping them clear of debris, of buildup, because you have parked cars between the bike lane and the vehicles, it's been harder for the city to maintain that bike lane over here. So that becomes a safety issue with the bicyclists. So I think, you know, through education efforts, there's ways to improve it. But yeah, I think those are a few things. So really the city and the MPO have been looking at what do they want to do? Is this a long-term thing? Do they, based on this information, do we want to change it? And so they've been studying that as well.
So it sounds like, have they already done some of that study? They've done a post-assessment study.
Yeah.
The city and the MPO did that. So talk a little bit about that study and what they found.
Yeah, so the post-assessment study included resident feedback who have been using the lanes, their own testimonials. So staff from the MPO and the city had used them themselves to understand maybe what some of these issues are. And then they met with some of the committees. There's a complete streets type bike committee with the city. And that's one of the things that really championed the project in the first place. So they all took that information and looked at other alternatives that could address some of those issues that I just mentioned, coming up with some different options. So one is just, we like what we have, but let's do a better job maintaining it and enforcing speed limits, the parking locations, and maybe we can delineate these lanes a little better. So that was one of the alternatives they looked at. Another one would be moving those bike lanes back next to the traffic and pushing the parking back to the edge of pavement, kind of maybe what's more traditionally done or more easily understood.
But that part right there, though, that kind of gets you, it's not as safe as a spot then for those bike lanes, right? Because the whole point of shifting it towards the curb is to protect them from the traveling vehicles from a safety perspective. So
yeah, there's right? Some so, balance.
There's kind of that balance. Mm-hmm. It's the balance you have to play between how safe do you want to be versus the functionality of it. And I think that's a tough part that we have to, that as engineers, that's something that we have to continuously evaluate to see what's those next steps.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you can't have it all. Right. So, by moving it inside, there are some benefits at the intersection. It makes it a little more safer because you don't have as much zigzagging with turning vehicles and getting and aligned in the right spot. So certainly some trade-offs with the alternatives. They looked at also implementing some bump outs at the intersections so that can reduce the pedestrian crosswalk length.
Yep.
And it really, what they found as well is that by reducing the speed limit, by reducing the number of lanes, these right turn lanes aren't really serving the function that they used to. And so they're finding that they're not even sure they're really necessary anymore. And so that's an opportunity to really define that parking area better. You can bump it out. You can reduce the crosswalk, slow anybody that's turning now. So there's a lot of safety benefits by doing that. So that's what the city MPO are looking at now. They're looking at a grant opportunity for adding some of that green paint I mentioned. They're going to do a test section with the corridor coming up here soon, test out a block or two and see if that improves the whether people understand where the bike lanes are or not. And so they're kind of continually taking steps to improve.
It's interesting because the stuff that you brought up as like, you know, resident feedback and staff feedback, a lot of those things, it seems like it's education based and of, hey, this is what needs to go on. Or you talk about the car that was parking up against the curb where the bike lane was. And, you know, it reminds me of, you know, when in some areas where roundabouts were starting to come about throughout the state, throughout different states, throughout the country, there was a huge push on education related to how do these things operate because people had no idea. And I think that's part of the aspect that it's the education piece that comes behind it as well as this is something that's different. And how do we go about educating the public to make sure that they're able to understand how this design that is safer functions?
Yeah. And it's difficult when it's one of those first projects in a city. As more come on board in the future, people will get more used to them. And yeah, you tend to get more compliance with it and a better understanding of how to function. I know talking to a colleague, there a similar installation happened, the same issue in Des Moines, Iowa, in another city where they had a similar alignment with the bike lane and they had the same exact parking issues there. So it's not just, you know, one city specific, it's happening all over. So that education component and those first projects that introduce that new type of facility, those are always the challenging ones.
So they did the assessment. What are the next steps that the city and the MPO are planning to take in order to expand and attract more bicyclists to dedicated systems in downtown Waterloo?
We're just talking about more education and outreach is something that they're aware of that's needed. Certainly, they've looked at trying to be able to enforce the police enforcement in terms of speeding to make it more comfortable for bicyclists. So more enforcement and better parking enforcement. You're limited with staff, but just trying to make sure that they're traveling the corridor frequently enough and enforcing whether a car is parking in there correctly. So education, enforcement, and then ongoing maintenance and monitoring of those of the bike lanes. So that's a big issue I talked about earlier. So they're taking those pieces, and that's just specific to this corridor. They are looking at another conversion for an intersecting street with Park Avenue. So that's kind of, once they get this figured out, they want to also expand it. So now you're starting to build a connected network where you're not just going back and forth, but now you can travel to another destination. And that'll further the desire for people to use bikes and walk on these streets. So one thing that I know the MPO did look for was additional funding sources. So they did secure some safety funding from the FHWA to further emphasize the locations where these improvements are needed and to build a better connected system. So that's something that they're going to continue to study, develop some plans for, and hopefully get some future funding to install those.
So in your opinion, what are the key benefits of creating these dedicated pedestrian and bike corridors in smaller cities similar to Waterloo?
Yeah, I'll break it down in a few things. So improved safety is one thing that we look at. And doing a lot of traffic engineering and safety projects, there's a big emphasis on the safe systems approach, which is used for Vision Zero, trying to eliminate deaths and severe injuries. So a lot of these elements that we're talking about are things that are part of that safe system approach. Separating bicyclists from vehicles, getting pedestrians more visible. So I think the safety aspect is really key. And we're also talking about disadvantaged communities in this case as well, because some people don't have access to a vehicle.
Right.
And it's, you know, if we don't provide the infrastructure needed for them to get to school, get to work, they're walking, they're biking, they're using transit. Those are vulnerable road users that have been often neglected. And so there's really a kind of a social responsibility, I think, on cities' parts to really take that into account. I think improved public health is something that you don't really necessarily think about all the time with transportation, but you're promoting more people to be active. You're reducing air pollution. You're getting people out of their car, walking, biking. So you're improving the climate. So a lot of those things that really just improve the quality of life.
I'm sure livability, sustainability, yep, other key factors, yep, that play into that. You talk a little bit about public health and how, you know, better for the environment, you know, contributing to the sustainability, but the livability and the sustainability, it has to be a great impact to the city as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so as engineers too, that's part of why we are engineers, right, is to make the world a better place. That's one of Stanley Consultant's core values. And so it's these are the types of projects and things that we get really excited about.
I'm sure we have a lot of engineers that are listening to this podcast and might work for a city and says, you know, this all sounds great, but I want to know more. What opportunities or programs are available for cities to apply for as it pertains to assistance to make a similar improvement in their city?
So a few that I'll just throw out right now, FHWA has some funding through their Transportation Alternatives Program, which is considered TAP. So that's for projects that enhance pedestrian and bicycle facilities. Safe Routes to School is another funding source. So if you have a location that's near a school and your project is going to improve safety, encourage walking and biking, so those projects could be eligible with the Safe Routes to School grant program. Safe Streets and Roads for All is another program that's in its second year. They just awarded their second year of funding for planning and demonstration grants. And road diets or road right-sizing reconfigurations, that's a proven safety countermeasure. FHWA, it's a proven safety countermeasure. So if you see, if an agency, a city saw the desire to do that, there's a process where you can develop your safety action plan first, and then you can pursue implementation funds so you can actually construct that and help get that paid for as well. So those are things that we're currently working on with some agencies on their safety action plan so we can hopefully get them some more money in the future to continue to do these new corridors. And then the other thing, there's always some state and regional programs. Sometimes MPOs and states will have some funding set aside for these types of projects. So the biggest thing is understanding what your options are, communicating with your MPOs, with your state officials, and understanding what programs are current and what will be out there.
Tyler, I appreciate all that you've said today and all that you've shared. Is there anything else that you want to highlight as it pertains to bike and pedestrian improvements in cities?
No, I think, I guess the last thing I would say is that find a champion in your city that really wants to drive that change, because that's what it can take sometimes to make it possible to have the type of, you know, these urban zones that are dedicated. Like you talked about, improving quality of life, vibrant public spaces. These are things that can be done, and it just takes a champion at the end of the day.
Please remember you can find the show notes for this episode at civilengineeringpodcast.com. There you will find a summary of the key points discussed in today's episode, as well as links to any of the resources, websites, or books mentioned during the episode. Until next time, I wish you the best in all of your civil engineering endeavors.